While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the Radio News Analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye. The eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis right here on Eagle FM. I'm your host, Nafa Happy Juju, and I'm here to keep you company on this Monday, the 23rd of March, 2026. Now, as we move through or in the beginning of the week, thank you for joining us for another edition of the program where we track, unpack, and make sense of the stories shaping our country and the world around us. Now, this afternoon, we continue to follow key developments across Namibia, from economic shifts and governance matters to innovation, youth development, and emerging opportunities. These are the issues that not only make headlines, but also directly influence how individuals, businesses, and communities navigate everyday life. Over the next 90 minutes, we'll take a closer look at the decisions, the trends, and events driving national progress and shaping regional dynamics. Our focus remains on providing clarity, going beyond the surface to better understand what these developments mean in practical terms, both now and in the near future. Now, in a fast-changing environment, staying informed is more important than ever. Through this platform, we aim to connect you with reliable information, thoughtful analysis, and meaningful conversations. Wherever you're listening from this afternoon, whether in Rudwitz, Hobabis, Okanja, Otapi, Karasburg, Opuo, or right here in Windhoek, thank you for being part of the conversation. This right here is On the Radar News Analysis on Eagle FM, keeping you informed, engaged, and connected to the issues shaping our nation. Now let's jump straight into these stories. The Namibia Financial Institutions Supervisory Authority, also abbreviated and well known as NAMFISA, is currently engaging fund administrators and members of the public following concerns raised since the introduction of the Financial Institutions and Markets Act, FIMA, in 2023. Now, speaking during the engagement, NAMFISA Chief Executive Officer Kenneth Matamola said a broad stakeholder report had previously been commissioned by the former Minister of Finance to assess public perceptions of the Act and its potential impact on financial funds across the country. Matamola explained that a technical committee was established by the ministry to gather concerns and insights, particularly focusing on how the legislation might affect the preservation of pension funds and other related investments. The aim, and I quote, "The main aim was to assess the preserved impact the Act would have on the preservation of pension funds or any other funds that could be impacted," he said. He noted that findings from the committee's report, which was submitted to the Minister of Finance, contributed to the decision not to implement certain provisions of the Act at this particular stage in time. Now, as a result, FIMA has not yet been enacted. Matamola further informed stakeholders that the report remains confidential and that the current round of industry engagements is intended to provide a platform for broader input and transparency. Participants at the session included labor unions and fund administrators, raising concerns about provisions within the Act, particularly those related to fund preservation, which continue to be a key point of contention within the ministry. Let's now take a listen to CEO of NAMFISA, that is Kenneth Matamola.
Billion worth of assets showed a low readiness with minimal or no formal preparation, no dedicated budgets. That's what you informed us. Therefore, in terms of the overall progress, we could say that funds reported, no fund reported 100% being done, because 100% can only be achieved once implementation happens. So I'm giving you this so that you see what the data that we are sitting with. When we talk about consultation, we are serious about consultation, so that you are able to make an informed decision. So in today's deliberation, let us be people-centric. Sometimes we forget that there is people that we save, that deemed it necessary to be part and parcel of these schemes. So let us be people-centric and ensure that we keep pace with the evolving financial landscape. Each one of us is encouraged. I reiterate this once more again. Actively raise practical implementation matters in a constructive and solution-oriented manner. Because now we are at the cusp of implementation. And therefore we need to raise implementation issues that we can deal with. The intention is to support smooth transition and effective FEMA application in practice by focusing on operational realities, system readiness, and implementation challenges that require clarification and support. So before I conclude, let me provide some important information. The Cabinet of the Republic of Namibia authorized the Minister of Finance to bring in two forms: the Financial Institution and Markets Act and the new NAMFISA Act. And I'm sure all of you received my note sometime last year just to inform you about that. In this regard, all the accompanying critical subordinate legislation will come into force on the date to be published in the Government Gazette. Maybe I should note here, when I mean about subordinate legislation, I refer to the regulation and standards that have undergone consultation and has been finalized. And this subordinate legislation has been available on our website for everyone to see, to take in interest. And now what is we are waiting for is for the minister to issue a notice in the Gazette to bring FEMA and its subordinate legislation into force. Maybe people will ask me, what is the minister still waiting for? Because I get that question more often. Because I don't only deal with yourselves, I deal with your other industries who are saying, hey, tenant, you are delaying us. I say, there is a process. The regulations which are issued by the minister, which you have seen, which have been consulted, go through a certain process. And that process requires legal drafting by Minister of Justice. They are not changing the substance. They want to make sure that they are clear. The substance remains as it has been agreed. And that is the process that is still being finalized. And my engagement with those who are responsible for ensuring that these are finalized, they seem to suggest that this process will come to an end mid of April. But I still need to see that. So they are putting it in, for lack of better word, in the legal language to make sure that they are clear and the intent of policymakers is not diluted. So my engagement with them, they said, Kenneth, we are on it. We will be finalizing the regulation mid of April. And we will make sure that when all is done, we would like to launch the NAMFISA and FEMA to the public. Nobody will not know what is happening. So that will be launched to everyone, to the external stakeholders. I'm sure you have received here and there some few notes of saying, please, there'll be some external launch of FEMA to the general public. And that will be done in conjunction with the Minister of Finance. Also, I must make it very clear. You will remember that the former Minister of Finance, from the advice of NAMFISA, created a technical task team to look at the preservation of retirement benefits. And that report was presented to the minister, and the recommendation there in there was, don't implement this regulation. Please go and rework these regulations. And the minister gave NAMFISA some marching orders and say, look, I have listened to the broader public. Please go and rework. After you have reworked, bring it here. But it requires a broader consultation with the general public. So once we have reworked, we have been given some timelines to rework. So the minister gave us enough timeline to rework that. Once we are ready, that regulation will come from the general public for their input. And that regulation will collect that information as we normally do. We will say, Peter said the following, John and Anna said the following. And this is the technical advice from NAMFISA, and the minister can make an informed decision. When the minister is happy, or if the minister will not be happy, then the minister will decide. So I can't decide for the minister. So we'll give her that, whatever John, Peter, Anna, and also forth will say. They say, this is what they have said, and this is the technical advice, and therefore make your own informed decision. Maybe a very important thing to say, because people sometimes confuse FEMA and preservation. The preservation is a regulation. It says in FEMA, the minister may issue the regulation. That's what it says. And therefore we can see that These are two different things. So the minister may decide not to issue. And for now, the matching orders is that rework, consult, and bring the rework document so that we, the minister, looks at it and make a decision. While that is happening, if the FEMA is implemented tomorrow, the status quo remains. It doesn't change. It will only change when the agreed regulation is brought into force. So I wanted to stress that one so that you are all aware that the minister has made a decision and that decision stands. So in closing, let us embrace the changing financial, regulatory and supervisory framework. Not with hesitation. You know, there's a saying in my language, it talks about the zebra. The zebra doesn't have horns. I don't know, I'm not so sure. Maybe it has, but I didn't see. I was in Itosha the other day, I saw a lot of them, I couldn't see the horns. And the reason why the zebra did not get horns, that's the saying in my language, is because the zebra was procrastinating to run to where the horns were. That's why it doesn't. So that can happen to us. The more we do that, the more we'll find ourselves 20, 30 years behind, and the world has moved. So let's embrace the change without hesitation, with determination. And if there are issues that need to be sorted out, let's do so with wisdom. And Namfisa is willing to listen at all times like we have done. Those who have engaged my office, they know that. Because in every change lies an opportunity to improve, to innovate, and to build a stronger future. So I thought I'd share with you my thoughts at the register, and thank you for your kind attention.
Welcome back. And now, of course, to get into more discussion on this, I'm joined by my colleague, Dwight Links. Good afternoon, Dwight, and welcome to On the Radar News Analysis.
Afternoon, Happy, and afternoon to the listeners.
Of course, Dwight, we're talking about NAMFISA, or the Namibia Financial Institution Supervisory Authority, engaging FAD administrators and members of the public. That is following a raised concerns in regards to the introduction of a FEMA. Now, what are some of the talking points that were held at this meeting, Dwight? And what perhaps is a way forward? What are some of those concerns about the public regarding FEMA that perhaps were also addressed?
All right. Thank you, Happy. So the particular conversation was a conversation that included members of funds, fund administrators, as well as also affiliated organizations and other entities to these particular funds. Now, currently, what we need to understand right now is that the act as it is, the FEMA Act, and I confirmed this with a discussion about there with one of the particular members of the public who obviously also showed up there, and I asked them, listen, does this technically mean that the FEMA Act is sort of like hanging in suspension, meaning it's not fully operational? And it was a yes, because they are part of the ecosystem of people that obviously represents members and employers and employees of various organizations. Mm-hmm. Now, the discussion, Happy, was regarding the interpretations of various terminology that is applied in the current act as it is. Now, what we need to understand here about the Namibian public that, you know, has to who was not obviously part of this particular discussion that took place this morning, was that it's a discussion about impact, about various particular stipulations within the Act that impacts the roles of multiple funds. So in many cases, we heard that a lot of the discourse that took place back in 2023 to 2024 was that people were just talking about retirement or pension funds for that matter. So retirement, those that impact the retirements of people and so forth. But for today, we got to hear about various kinds of funds. There's a provident fund. There's a different kind of fund that obviously plays a particular different kind of a role. And then there's also the role of potential insurance that's associated to various benefits that said particular, let's say the member, that being an employee of a client company that had a particular account with a service provider of said particular fund facility. And these would include things like death benefits or funeral benefits and those kinds of further add-on services. Now, the conversation here primarily was the fund administrators were present, and the fund administrators were conducting this particular engagement with NAMFISA on behalf of members. So we don't know if the members are clearly identify or define employers, or it directly speaks to the employees who obviously retired and then obviously are accessing their particular monies that is held by these various fund facilities.
Interesting. Now, they did speak about not including that there was a decision not to implement certain provisions of the Act, that is certain provisions within the FEMA Act at this particular stage. Is there anything that was reviewed on what some of those provisions were that were not yet included in the Act?
Well, Happy, like I said a little bit earlier, the Act is not in play yet, meaning the Act is not functioning yet.
Yeah.
Reason being is that the previous minister, according to the CEO of NAMFISA, that being Mr. Kenneth Matamola, is that the former finance minister tasked or actually put together a technical team to go and see what is the situation, why is there so much resistance to this FEMA Act. The technical team had compiled a report that Mr. Matamola also identified to the audience at the stakeholder engagement. This report is not public yet. But the report, basically, in what he summarized, is that the report highlighted a negative reception and a negative perception between the impacted stakeholders. So we talk about fund administrations or fund administrators and members to these funds. So we're talking about two particular ecosystem participants besides the public sector discussion. Now, much of the other conversation when the FEMA Act was being gazetted in 2023, which was also then factored or actually featured as a major conversation in 2024, was the discussion of the preservation. Now, how you need to look at FEMA, Happy, is that FEMA has this discussion of a preservation activity. So a preservation activity means a percentage of the fund is maintained by the fund administrator, so that the only a third or a percentage of said particular fund or said particular money is paid to the beneficiary, which is obviously the member to said fund. Now, that was some of the discourse and some of the confusion that erupted between 2023 to 2024, because the broader public was trying to understand what does this actually mean. So what does it actually mean is, currently, right now, the members of the public who are members of funds and fund administrators can still act and can still interact with their fund administrator as has been the case ever since. So currently, right now, the FEMA Act is not in play. It's not impacting the accessibility to the particular monies of the various people. However, the discussion today was trying to understand definitions, interpretations, trying to see if there's any other further concerns that fund administrators are trying to highlight. For example, liabilities to add on benefits, like the funeral benefit discussion I mentioned in the previous comment. because there's a conversation between if there is a funeral, or let's say if there is a member who passed away because of old age or whatever the circumstances, and the beneficiaries, meaning the family, the leftover family of said particular member, now have to go and claim. So they now have to go and start the process of laying in claims towards what is the left of the member's particular money, and as well as also other potential benefits that they probably did not know of, and they're trying to find as much information as possible, mm-hmm. because many of us will go through this particular process, is that, for example, if there are any other particular services or benefits associated to what the original member had, that the discussion was based upon, should the beneficiaries now run around and go and talk to many people, or should everything be centralized at the fund administrator who was acting on behalf of the interests of the original member, i.e. let's say the parent or a grandparent, so on and so forth. So currently right now, the status discussion is about when will the FEMA Act come into play. Indications were given there by one of the legal representatives of NAMFISA that supposedly the plan is, or that there is rumors that by middle April or end of April, FEMA might come into act.
Yeah.
There has not been a clear indication, Happy, in the speech of the finance minister regarding FEMA. So there's also uncertainty regarding when FEMA will actually come into play. We also have to see how broadly based the stakeholder engagements would be, because this is a Windhoek-based stakeholder engagement. Conversation will obviously be, was everyone here who represents all particular economic entities across the country who are registered with a fund administrator, which is a service provider under NAMFISA, and other service providers who play a role in this particular ecosystem, were they present at this discussion, or will we still see further ones after this?
Interesting, hey? Kind of interesting. And I take it that there's obviously a lot that needs to be discussed still with obviously the recipients of it not being recipients now. I mean, of course, the fund administrators and probably also people who then have been able to access their funds, having also to give their contribution to say, you know, this are some of the specific reasons why we wouldn't want this and this to be included in FEMA. And I think that's a very good thing for what the former Minister of Finance did, to actually send out a committee of people to go and assess the recipient of, to go and assess how they receive this or perhaps don't receive it. And I think it should be the norm with anything that is ought to be implemented. We first need to assess whether people are for it or perhaps they're not for it.
Happy, the particular concern of this that stems from there is that there was a specific section that was that under the particular session of perceived conflict areas regarding the FEMA Act, which was highlighted, is a discussion in terms of any other legislation that FEMA is tied to. So we're talking about the registration, let's for example say the Income Tax Act of Namibia. There's also a scenario with regards to another particular act regarding financial institutions, because you get banking financial institutions, you get non-banking financial institutions, mm-hmm. which also includes the insurance companies in that scenario. And how do these particular registrations of entities that are registered with NAMFISA, because there is a scenario of registration with NAMFISA, and like you have to register with the central bank if you're a bank, with NAMFISA if you're an insurance company, or any other particular non-financial or non-banking institute, you've got to be registered with NAMFISA. How do the relevant legislations play into their own legislation, connect to each other, impact each other, also impact the Income Tax Act, which obviously falls under NAMRA's particular purview? How does that also impact the separate legislation that you would find under labor law or under the relevant labor acts, as well as also how are all of these tied to each other? Now, the conversation started specifically just on that particular pillar. I could unfortunately not stay the whole particular session, primarily because the indication is that it had a lot of deliberation. There was a lot of discourse. There was a lot of misunderstanding regarding the language being used,
mm-hmm.
because this is what goes into legal drafting, is a discussion of what, if you put a word there, what does this word actually try to say or to mean within the sentence itself?
Mm.
And there was, on the notion of other benefits, primarily one of the two particular participants in the audience highlighted, because there is a phrase that says, and other benefits, the word other is a very broad term. And said particular broad term could imply a lot of particular things. So they were also seeking, you know, will there be clarity shown in terms of some kinds of language used specifically in acts and in legislation when they are drawn up that impacts the non-banking financial sector of Namibia's overall economy.
Mm, I hear you. Dwight, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reading News Analysis.
Not a problem, Abby.
Okay. And of course, now let's take a listen to Ryan. And Ryan is a policymaker at FEMA, also just giving some bit of an understanding on what this is all about. Let's take a listen.
So in terms of the chief issue we had was a conflict between the Act, which is FEMA, and the subordinate legislation. And you specifically referred to the definitions of defined contribution fund, definition of member, and the definition of a retirement fund. And you also referred to retirement fund standard number, which deals with the rules of retirement funds. So maybe from the outset, there's a regulation number RFR 5.1, which recognizes preservation funds and retirement annuity funds as they are defined in the Income Tax Act for the purposes of the definition of a fund in FEMA, right? That also applies to the definition of pension fund and the definition of provident fund in terms of the Income Tax Act. So FEMA, via regulation, recognizes those two funds, or those four types of funds, as defined in the Income Tax Act for the purposes of FEMA, right? Now that brings me to the definition of a defined contribution fund, FEMA. You'll see under section 249, that definition is broken down into four subsections, A, B, C, and D. Now the problematic provision is actually subparagraph B of that definition, which forces annuitization of the full benefit that members are entitled to when they retire. Okay. Now the policy direction that we received from our principal, the Minister of Finance, because this definition now affects the operation of provident funds specifically, provident preservation funds, we call full annuitization. Now we know in terms of the Income Tax Act, with a provident fund, you are allowed to commute the entire benefit as a lump sum at retirement. Now FEMA, via paragraph B of the definition now, seeks to change that, to convert provident funds into pension funds when annuitization is required. Now, given that inconsistency or that conflict between these two pieces of legislation, and the policy direction from the minister was that provident funds in its current form must remain, with vested benefits being protected, but the minister wants to phase out provident funds, you know, over time. So basically what that means, members of existing provident funds should be able to commute up to 100% of their benefit as a tax, as a lump sum upon retirement. And given that policy direction we received from the Minister of Finance, we have advised the minister, when the minister publishes the date for implementation of FEMA, for the minister to stay that paragraph B or that subparagraph B of that definition. That definition, that subparagraph B, also empowers an officer to issue a standard, and that is the standard number RFS 5.11, which speaks to alternative forms of payment of pension benefits for the purpose of defined contribution funds. Right? So our advice to the minister was, when FEMA is implemented, let's stay that provision, which means the definition of defined contribution fund will now only consist of subparagraphs A, C, and D of that definition, as it is in Section 249, right? So there is an advisory at the minister, and we expect that to follow through on that, which will mean provident funds will remain for the time being. Yes, Klaus.
Ryan, yeah, thank you. Klaus, you mentioned just provident funds. I mean, and I understand.
Okay, and for now, let's pause here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly to stay tuned on the reading news analysis.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko tete opoye ekukurile. Oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge fata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora etatuimwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile konderewa mura hetatu natu bali o hetatu batatu oma filane Eagle FM. The eye.
Welcome back. Now, of course, today is Monday, which means that today's The Villager e-paper is out. Now, it covers the following headlines. Government faces $36.9 billion repayment obligations in 4 years. Corrugated iron manufacturer produces approximately 80 tons annually. That's an interesting story that was covered regarding that Tulumukwa Haikali, who is the owner of Rooftech Company, dedicated to nearly 5 years researching how to enter the manufacturing industry in a manner that would benefit Namibians and stimulate economic growth. Now he highlights or speaks on how he started this company with his own savings. And of course, he did experience hardships here and there, tried to look for finances. And even though he didn't get the loan that he perhaps wanted to get, he still continued to invest with his own personal savings. And eventually now today, they are shipping even to Botswana and Angola, to neighboring countries as well, and producing not only for Namibia, but for Angola, exporting to Angola and Botswana, which he says will benefit our economy as well. Now, opens up my mind to say, sometimes the business that is on your mind is waiting for you to fund it, and sometimes you might not get the fundings outside there, but you might need to actually fund it with your own savings. But then at the end of the day, it brings in more than what actually you put into it. Previous agriculture ministry blamed for Omaheke uranium stalemate. Now, in a report by the National Assembly Standing Committee on Natural Resources, the committee indicated that a variety of factors hampered the second half of uranium exploration activities, where the in-situ recovery reaching method was used in the Omaheke region. In their findings, they say the committee discovered that Head Springs investment drilling permits were revoked by the former Ministry of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform, Carol Sleipving. Make sure you grab today's copy to read up furthermore on that. Basecamp celebrates Women's Month by spotlighting female founders. The Basecamp Business Incubator hosted its first Nexus Speed Bench event of the year at the Denley's Music Cafe in Windhoek last Thursday that the quarterly event allows funders of businesses still in the ideation phase the opportunity to pitch their ideas for a chance to win $5,000. Achipara backs bailout of strategic SOEs. Country remains with adequate fuel supply, MIME, that is the Ministry of, according to the Ministry of Industry, Mines and Energy. Let's grab today's e-paper and read up on this headlines and more. For now, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly. Stay tuned.
Phew, what a day. Finally on my way home. And hey, the taxi's empty. So much room. Oh no, why is this big guy getting in and sitting on top of me? No, not the Mimo with the big bag too. Now I'm squeezed.
Sometimes in life, you just get squeezed. But luckily, with Express Credit's term loans, you can get up to 32,000 Namibian dollars to help ease your financial squeeze in under 15 minutes.
Ah, now that's a relief.
Visit expresscredit.com.na. Express Credit, money when you need it.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nengelo wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe utete okoye ekukuli.
Welcome back. Last week, Namibia joined the global community in marking Brain Awareness Week, an annual initiative dedicated to increasing public understanding of the brain and promoting awareness around neurological health. Now led internationally by Dana Foundation, the campaign highlights the importance of brain research, early detection of neurological conditions, and the everyday habits that influence cognitive well-being. Now, while the week often features academic discussions and health campaigns, educators say some of the most critical messages remain widely overlooked by the public. Health professionals emphasize that brain health is not only a concern for the elderly or those diagnosed with neurological conditions such as Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease, but a lifelong priority that begins in childhood and continues through adulthood. One of the most commonly overlooked aspects is the impact of lifestyle on brain function. Poor sleep, chronic stress, lack of physical activity, and unhealthy diets significantly affect memory, concentration, and long-term cognitive resilience. Despite this, many people still underestimate the importance of consistent sleep patterns and mental rest, often prioritizing productivity over recovery. Another critical issue is mental health. Conditions such as depression and anxiety disorders are commonly linked to brain function. Yet stigma continues to prevent many individuals from seeking help. Now, educators stress that mental health is an essential component of overall brain health and should be treated with the same urgency as physical conditions. Brain Awareness Week also brings attention to the silent risk associated with head injuries, even mild concussions, often dismissed in sports or everyday accidents, can have lasting effects if not properly managed. Now, repeated head trauma has been linked to long-term cognitive decline, making early diagnosis and rest crucial. In addition, there is a growing concern about the role of substance abuse in brain damage. Excessive alcohol consumption and drug use can impair brain development, particularly among young people, affecting decision-making, memory, and emotional regulation. Importantly, early screening and education remain key. Many neurological conditions develop gradually with symptoms that are often ignored or misinterpreted. Some signs such as persistent headaches, memory lapses, mood changes, or difficulty concentrating may warrant medical attention but are frequently dismissed. Now, as the awareness continues, educators are urging the public to adopt proactive habits, maintaining a balanced diet, engaging in regular physical activity, protecting mental health, and seeking medical advice when unusual symptoms arise. Now, we will get into further discussions on this with the doctor on the radar soon enough. Stay tuned. Not necessarily today, but we'll definitely get into touch with a doctor to come and educate us on Brain Awareness Week. So do stay tuned every Monday to Friday, specifically this week, to see when we're actually going to discuss it. Ultimately, also, Brain Awareness Week serves as a reminder that brain health is central to every aspect of life, from learning and productivity to emotional well-being, and that small consistent actions can have a significant difference over time. With that being said, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back with economic indicators. Thereafter, news beyond the borders of Namibia. Stay tuned.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva Tero ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukurile oshafafana nongeshe faili mehola mo ihoetike kovano ile koshuala onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa ninge kwata Fanona, Monica, Co, Eagle FM, Honora Tatime, Bali Heali, Nola Natu, Heali Bali, No Heali, Ileko, Berewa, Nora Hetatu Natu, Bali O Hetatu Watatu, Oma Felane, Eagle FM, the Eye.
Welcome back, and now let's get into today's economic indicators. $1 today is equals to 16.89 Namibian dollars, and $1 is equals to 11 Namibian dollars and 82 cents. $1 is equals to 4 Namibian dollars and 60 cents, while €1 is equals to 19 Namibian dollars a point 52 cents. £1 is equals to 22 Namibian dollars and 57 cents. While one Botswana pula is equals to one Namibian dollar and 24 cents. Enough for news beyond the borders of Namibia. Let's start off in South Africa and move over to other news. Steep fuel price hikes for South African motorists in April 2026.
Price increase coming to effect in April. That's next week. Motorists must brace for a steep fuel price increase coming to effect in April. That's next week, Wednesday, the 1st of April. The latest fuel price forecast from the Central Energy Fund in South Africa has indicated that 95-octane petrol could see a price increase of over 5 rand a litre. The Fuel Industry Association of South Africa has also raised concerns about the affordability of fuel in the coming months. Motorists have been urged to avoid panic buying ahead of April's price changes, and this could place unnecessary pressure on the supply system. The biggest petrol price hike over a single month in South Africa was in July 2022. That was when prices went up by 2.57 rand a litre. And this was following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And this, of course, has now doubled if you look at the prices now. In fact, diesel is estimated to perhaps even go up by about 9 rand a litre. Now, of course, this war between Iran, the U.S., and Israel has injected significant geopolitical risks into energy markets. Now, to look at the implications, we are joined by economist Dr. Iraj Abidian and chief executive at the Fuel Industry Association of South Africa, Abafani Tifalaro. Gentlemen, thank you. As always, it's such a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Good morning to you both. Let me begin with you, Mr. Tifalaro. Let's talk about the message right now, and I think it's important we get the messaging right up front. What message are you sending to all stakeholders about this fuel price adjustment that we expect in April, well, next week, Wednesday?
I think while it's understandable that people are panicking because, I mean, of the published Central Energy Fund, I mean, under recovery figures, which are predicting quite a steep high price, I mean, come the 1st of April, people are starting to, find a way of, how can I protect myself? I mean, we're talking about from individual motorists and business. So we are encouraging that, I mean, we need not to deviate from our normal purchasing pattern, because if we all start to rush to the service station or to our normal suppliers, it puts significant pressure into the supply chain, and it becomes very difficult for the suppliers to respond because we don't have additional trucks to suddenly cater for that additional artificial demand. So if we all can stick to our normal purchasing pattern, it will help, everybody get fuel because, from what we can see, there's no shortage of product. We are able to import both crude oil and finished products into the country. And based on the plans that have been shared by our member companies and other suppliers, we can see that, there is no disruption in terms of the plans of lending imports into the country. So, we've got sufficient stocks. Yes, it will take some time for some other areas to be serviced because, of extra demand that has been exerted in the supply chain.
Yeah. So let's now come to you, Dr. Bedian, and we need to get a proper understanding as to, we know how serious the situation is because we're looking at all of the indicators, whether we talk about the Brent crude price, which I see this morning is sitting at around about $113 a barrel. I mean, this is a massive increase. We're now having ultimatums sent by Trump to Iran, Iran firing back saying, listen, do what you want, because then we're going to just close the strait entirely. Now, talk to us about how things are looking this week. We're on Monday. We're beginning in a new week, and it doesn't look like anything is de-escalating at this point.
Yeah, good morning, Leanne, and good morning to our colleagues and the viewers. At the moment, the talk is getting tougher and gets more hostile. And in this situation, of course, there are back diplomatic movements to kind of cool the situation, but it's highly unlikely because you have two kind of adversaries, President Trump, who is under pressure to finish it quickly. Time is not on his side for the Iranian regime. The time, as they see it, is on their side, and they can tolerate a lot of suffering on the part of people. So, and the Strait of Hormuz has always been their last survival tool. If they lose out on the Strait of Hormuz, then the entire regime is highly likely to collapse. So they know that. Therefore, we cannot expect a cooling off of confrontational talk and engagements. In this context, Leanne, the war is going to get more and more widespread. It has already spread to the region. It's not just between Israel, the United States, and Iran. 12 Arab countries have signed the pact last week, condemning and expressing very strong intention to defend themselves. And that's another language for we may get into the action, unfortunately. So I think it's a very, very tense and heightened socio-political, geopolitical risk. And in this context, in South Africa and most of Africa, we have two problems. One is the price, the dollar price of oil, as you mentioned, it is going up and staying up. Secondly, we also have our currency under attack. We've had over the past 2 weeks our currency losing almost 10-15%, which adds up to the rand value of our diesel and petrol. And it's a very, very concerning situation we are sitting
in. Yeah, I mean, Dr. Bidin, it really is. And you know, this is a new week we've started. We're even seeing the commodity prices going down. And, I mean, we're still in great shape on commodities, but from not so long ago, over 5,000.
Care that goes where you go. That's international travel insurance through NHP. We facilitate cover of up to 10 million Namibian dollars per member for medical emergencies abroad as part of your membership. No extra charge. To receive your policy within minutes, simply register at nhp.com.na before you travel. T's and C's apply. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
E-waste for youth employment in Limpopo.
The project comes at a time when youth unemployment remains above 30% in Limpopo. The initiative led by the International Labour Organization has partnered with local municipalities. It has equipped young people, women and persons with disabilities with practical skills in e-waste collection, refurbishment and recycling. Some beneficiaries say the program has provided them with technical knowledge. It has also given them the business skills to start and sustain their own enterprises and employ fellow youth.
I was into waste, but I didn't have the idea that I can turn the waste into a business. The ILO helped me to generate the idea to actually take the waste and develop it into a business, whereby I managed to employ two people in my area to come and help me with the e-waste.
Since I started with ILO, we know how to dismantle. And then also how to sorting, and also how to collect. And then we also benefit from ILO because we got the storage. Beside a storage, we have the other skills that we trained from ILO with the other company.
Started with plastic waste. At that time, we employed about 20 youth, all of them. And since as time went by, we couldn't be able to like afford them, so we had to let them go, some of them. But as we started venturing more into e-waste now, we're starting to regain more people than we expected last time.
The Japanese government has funded the project with more than $1.5 million. The funds are aimed at creating jobs and promoting sustainable waste management.
This is a very important and serious issue. But at the same time, we see that in this country and especially in this province, we see the issue of unemployment. And also, we see that due to the climate change, there are many the natural disasters such as heavy rains and floods hit this province. This province of Limpopo are facing various difficulties. And now ILO proposed this project of e-waste for youth employment. And we, Japanese government, thought that this may be very important project. And also this may be, this is the pilot project to be implemented in South Africa.
The collaboration with municipalities will ensure that beneficiaries are supported.
One of the things that we are pushing
in terms of it is a donor or a project with the ILO comes with an initiative. How do we get this into the provincial budget as a way of sustaining it? So in implementing the program, we had municipalities being part of it. We brought the waste pickers and the municipalities together to start talking to each other. So for us, the long-term sustainability is not so much around a project from the ILO. The long-term sustainability is to have this as part of the budgets for the municipality.
Waste management is a serious problem in South Africa. Serious. Everywhere you go, there are waste lying around. That is, well, waste management is not organized. Specifically in this municipality as well. We're sitting with situations where we really cannot manage it. And I think that we will definitely support this to make it a bigger situation that we can involve our youth.
South Africa continues to battle high youth unemployment, with many young people struggling to access opportunities. 16 beneficiaries of the e-waste program in Limpopo have already registered companies. Rendane Ralepaso, SABC News, Polokwane.
World Water Day, inclusive water management is vital for sustainability. Let's hear more.
Of course, Dr. Feriel Adam from WaterCan, who's coming to share some insight as South Africa continues grappling with the water crisis as we celebrate International Water Day today. Doctor, it's such a pleasure to have you with us. So quite painful, the fact that we are still dealing with serious water challenges right across some parts of the country as a direct result of issues that should have been long addressed, right? How is our current national supply as well as accessibility to clean, safe water as we celebrate this day today? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Alicia, and thank you for having me on your show. And good afternoon to all your viewers. Yeah, I mean, I think we're not doing very well at all. If we're honest, I think that in terms of, you know, both Human Rights Day yesterday and World Water Day, and water being a basic human right, we're failing on all fronts. If we look at the fact that half of our drinking water systems are not fit for drinking, that 70% of our wastewater treatment works are not working, that 25% of our schools don't have proper running water, that there's still a lot of schools with pit latrines. And this day and age, I think that we are actually performing quite badly. You know, we're not even able to, government says that we are meeting our sustainable development goals in terms of water, but I think that we're not. If we look at the statistics, and if we look at the numbers of people without access to clean, safe drinking water, as well as to sanitation, then I think we are really not performing very well on this day.
Doctor, I've been judging from the recent statements from the various media briefings by the relevant authorities and entities who are still saying infrastructure basically is the main challenge and will cost the country billions to address this situation. However, we both know that these challenges are far deeper than just infrastructural, right? Governance issues as well as corruption are impeding heavily on viable solutions to address these challenges.
Absolutely. And I think that is a key point, is that you can point the fingers and yes, infrastructure is damaged. And yes, we've allowed our infrastructure to deteriorate over a decade, right? But we have very poor leadership. We have very poor governance, and there's mismanagement at municipal level. If you look at the statistic as well, that if 73% of our water service authorities, those are your municipalities, are actually failing in their job. How is it that they still get the grants, they still get the loans? And that is very concerning. And the corruption around water, as you rightfully say, is bleeding the system dry.
Absolutely, Doctor. I mean, 56% of wastewater treatment plants are currently in poor or critical condition. 37 to 42% of treated water municipalities are losing 37 to 42% of water due to leaking pipes and infrastructural failures. And of course, the lack of access to clean and safe water leads to a wide range of social as well as regional impact, Doctor, and not just for those who at least have taps, even if they are dry. Doctor, the reality is there are still some rural communities that have never had running water, and it is 2026, a severe violation, as you said earlier, of their basic human rights.
Absolutely. The fact that people don't have, they have the tap, but there's no water in their tap. And this is, you're right. It's across the rural areas, but also in many urban settings and peri-urban settings, this is becoming the norm. So I think that and the way government defines access. So they'll say, if you look at government statistics, they'll say 95% have access to water, but we need to unpack that access because they don't have water in their homes. They don't have working taps in their yard. They have to walk at least 200 meters. And over and above all of that, there's still about 10% of South Africans who have to rely on the very polluted rivers that you covered and you talked about in your earlier show. They have to rely on that as their main source of water. You know, this impacts health. It impacts education. It impacts small businesses. And basically, that in itself means that people cannot live full lives. And that is a violation of your human rights.
Now, government has announced, Doctor, a few interventions like enhancing and implementing your leak repairs and construction of some additional infrastructure in some areas in order to, they say, assist authorities to be able to manage the water supply. Is this achievable even under the current circumstances, you think?
I think that it has to go hand in hand with a lot more. So it's not enough to say we're setting up these structures to do it. And also, government has this habit of saying, oh, well, things have failed here. Let's outsource it to the private sector.
Yeah.
No, I think that we need to look at how do we create better partnerships? How do we include the civil society groups that have been very vocal on water and find a collaborative approach? I think the Water Sector Anti-Corruption Forum was one of the first few forums where I see that they focus on we need to have cross-collaboration. And without that, you're right, then we are going to be keep putting money into leaking buckets. We are going to keep sitting in this situation where people don't have water and infrastructure is not going to be fixed.
Absolutely, Doctor. Thank you so much for joining us and unpacking that with us. That is Dr. Feriel Adam of Water Can Day, unpacking the existential water challenges as, of course, the world observes Water Day today.
Meanwhile, even though it's Water Day or World Water Day last yesterday, Johannesburg water crisis worsens amid aging infrastructure.
Johannesburg, the continent's richest city, once at the heart of South Africa's gold rush, is now facing an unprecedented water crisis, not because of droughts or supply shortages, but rather failing infrastructure and weak governance.
When we're dealing with the outages that we're seeing right now, it's because the system is completely strained, it's fragile, and it cannot deal with the demand, the growing population. We've seen a deterioration in our infrastructure, and it also then requires a lot more funding to fix.
Shortages, once confined to the margins of the city, have spread into financial districts, cutting off taps in rapidly expanding middle-class suburbs, where development has outpaced infrastructure and maintenance. Uzayi Paruk, a resident of Midrand, says the situation is distressing.
Living without water really and truly is a struggle. You know, with electricity, as we know in South Africa, we have load shedding. We've adjusted, we've figured out ways to adapt. And without water, our life kind of stopped.
High consumption is also being blamed for constrained supply, but deep inequalities rooted in apartheid remain.
You've got areas that are very, very wealthy, that have swimming pools, 3 bathrooms. Each bedroom has one, you know, there's all of those kind of things. And then you've got this growing poor population that cannot even afford to pay their bills, that you are claiming are using the same amount of water as the wealthier areas. That's not fair.
Significant volumes of water are also lost to leaks and theft.
You could probably cut it down to about 15% of the amount of water, because pipes are always going to leak. But we could probably cut it easily if we replaced pipes and people fixed their internal plumbing as well, because a lot of leaks occur internally in houses as well.
Nearly $4 billion is needed to resolve the city's water crisis. So far, just $44 million has been allocated by the provincial legislature to begin upgrading the network.
Water storage facilities are the future, so that when we are hit by this kind of explosion, the water storage will continue to provide water in our province. For now, we are planning at least to have water storage that can carry us for almost 7 days. But in Midrand, we are building a new water storage facility to house 20 million liters of water.
Africa's bold vision is to turn water security into a driver of development by 2063. But in Johannesburg, the engine of South Africa's economy, that vision is being undermined by crumbling infrastructure and delayed reform. Without urgent intervention, the taps in Africa's richest city may run dry with far-reaching consequences for growth, investment, and daily life. Judy Shire, CHTN.
Meanwhile, Kenya, Uganda launch SGR extension linking the two nations.
Kenyan President William Ruto and his Ugandan counterpart Yoweri Museveni have jointly commissioned an extension of the standard gauge railway that will link the two countries. Ruto and Museveni met in Kisumu on the Kenyan side of the shared border to mark the groundbreaking. It comes a day after Ruto commissioned the construction of a section of the SGR between the Kenyan cities of Naivasha and Kisumu. The original line connecting the port city of Mombasa to cities further inland was completed in 2017. The new phase commissioned Saturday will stretch over 100 kilometers from Kisumu to Malaba on the border with Uganda, which is also preparing to extend the line further to its capital city, Kampala.
Your Excellency, this is a very proud moment for us as Kenya, as we see this infrastructural development that is not just a rail, it is a commercial lifeline, it is a logistics hub, and it is a regional investment that is going to transform the business environment, is going to transform the fortunes of our farmers, of our producers, of our industrialists, of our business people, and create wealth in our region.
Our plan is to transfer all heavy cargo to the railway, then transfer all the petroleum products to the pipeline. The railway can combine also water transport. This now leaves the roads for passengers and light cargo.
CGTN's Daniel Arap Moore has more on the potential of the railway extension.
On May 31st, 2017, the standard gauge railway commuter train embarked on its maiden voyage from Kenya's coastal city of Mombasa, beginning a 472-kilometer journey to the capital, Nairobi. Today, nearly 8 years later, the commuter train is ferrying millions of passengers annually across one of the country's busiest transport corridors. In 2025, revenue from passenger traffic alone stood at $37.1 million, and the cargo volume had shot up to 7.48 million tons, generating $128.7 million for the railway service. And in recent months, strong demand for passenger services has prompted the railway service to add extra trains in order to meet the growing demand.
It's really amazing because you feel like you're in a plane and it's very, very comfortable. Again, you're able to go watching the nature, watching the animals. It was really, really good.
And I think it's about time, after 100 years, that we finally got another railway that works, and not only works well, but works in a spectacular way.
Officials say the shift to rail has eased road congestion by reducing bulk cargo on major highways, cutting costs, saving time, and improving safety. The new 369-kilometer extension will stretch from Naivasha to Busia on the Uganda border, traversing 8 counties, including Narok, Bomet, Kericho, and Kisumu. The project design includes 13 tunnels, 23 bridges, and 376 culverts. Uganda is preparing to extend the line from the border to its capital, Kampala, with the possibility of pushing it on farther into neighboring Rwanda. Once it's completed, it's expected to significantly boost trade volume in the region and that's a big development for Uganda. In the first 6 months of 2025, the landlocked country received nearly 70% of the 7.37 million tons of cargo transiting through the Kenyan port of Mombasa. However, without an efficient railway line, it can take up to 80 hours to move cargo from Mombasa to the Ugandan border and over 100 hours to Kampala. Daniel Arap Moi, CGTN.
Kenya and China mark decades-long strategic partnership.
It's been 63 years since Kenya and China established diplomatic relations. Over that time, China has emerged as one of Kenya's most important development partners and in recent years, its largest trading partner. In 2025, the two countries elevated ties to a comprehensive strategic partnership in the new era following President William Ruto's visit to Beijing. The visit yielded agreements across infrastructure, agriculture, health, education, and ICT, aimed at accelerating Kenya's economic growth. Among the key infrastructure projects signed was the 371-kilometer extension of the standard gauge railway from Naivasha to the port city of Kisumu on Lake Victoria and onward to Malaba at the Uganda border. Construction of the project was launched last week. Also underway is the upgrading of the 175-kilometer Rironi-Mau Summit Highway, a key transport corridor linking Nairobi to western Kenya. And in Naivasha, construction has begun on a geothermal-powered fertilizer plant expected to produce 480,000 tons annually. Over the past decade, the partnership has delivered more than 100 projects. These include the initial Nairobi-Mombasa Standard Gauge Railway, the Nairobi Expressway, the Thika Superhighway, and the Kipevu Oil Terminal. In energy, the 50-megawatt Garissa Solar Plant remains the largest grid-connected solar facility in eastern Central Africa, while in technology, Chinese firms have supported projects such as the Konza Data Center. The partnership is now shifting toward value addition and expanding access for Kenyan exports to Chinese markets. From May 2026, China will eliminate tariffs on imports from 53 African countries, including Kenya, a move expected to unlock new opportunities for exporters and further boost economic ties. Robert Nagela, CGTN.
Turbulences in fuel markets is hitting African airlines quite hard.
Turbulence in the fuel markets caused by the US-Israel war on Iran is hitting African airlines hard. Jet fuel prices are soaring worldwide, but Africa is particularly exposed. About 70% of its jet fuel and kerosene imports come through the Strait of Hormuz, the vital maritime corridor currently under blockade by Iran. Since the start of the conflict last month, shipping through the strait has almost stopped, removing about a fifth of global oil supplies from the market. For African airlines, jet fuel accounts for between 30 to 40% of operating costs, a far greater percentage than for many other carriers. For low-cost African airlines, that figure's closer to 55%, increasing the financial strain of the current crisis. The rapidly changing cost of fuel makes route planning and pricing unpredictable. Operators can't quote flights too far in advance at the risk of losing money if fuel prices spike.
And now let's hear on how China and Nigeria have intercultural exchange, how their intercultural exchanges help bring the cultures closer or the countries closer.
Of the Chinese community in Nigeria, and joining us there, he is the research fellow, assistant research fellow, Lagos State University.
The people-to-people level will deepen whatever bilaterals we're having with China. We have a huge Nigerian diaspora population in China that are doing very well. Students, they've gone on exchanges, businessmen and all that. So what we say is that we need more engagements amongst the people of China and the people of Nigeria for a better understanding of this relationship. For instance, we talk a lot about one of the areas we need to... For instance, when I was in China, mm-hmm. I had a conversation with the Chinese. Why are you investing so much on the continent? And they said, we just want to be your friends. We just want to be partners with you. We just want to add value. And I believe them. So with people to people, it's the people you use. People in your country, people in our country. For instance, when we talk with them, areas of prioritization, for instance, the issue of industrialization is very important. How do you, you know, ensure that on both sides of the divide? And we need to enhance trade and expand exchanges. Cultural exchange, for instance. Imagine a people-to-people exchange through culture is going to be very, very powerful. There are a lot of Nigerians that are in China and are learning Chinese language. That is it. And there are also a lot of Chinese in Nigeria that are learning the three major languages, Igbo, Hausa, Yoruba. And, you know, when we continue like this, we're going to deepen the relationship.
Dr. Oyelami, let me come to you here. 2026 is the year of people-to-people exchanges, and Honorable Erewa has explained what is required. From that context, though, how do you define the significance of a year being, the significance of it being people-to-people exchanges?
Nigeria and China, we've done a whole lot together. You know, it's that time we deepen the relationship by bringing people together, and we can even go further, localizing this relationship. You know, like Nigerian going to China, going to local places, learning Chinese languages. They can as well come to Nigeria. You know, we have a whole lot of them around, you know, going to Nigerian local area. But it's not going to be just for business purposes this time around. It's going to be for cultural change. They learn about the local people here and all of that. These are things we can actually do at the people-to-people level to deepen our relationship.
Currently, we have the Happy Chinese New Year here. We have the Ni Hao program. And then in January, Nigeria and China signed the second committee minute to commence a 5-year strategic plan, and all of that all sound really applaudable. But one will ask, is it as effective as it sounds? What are some of those hurdles that should be removed to make this people-to-people relations between Nigeria and China more effective?
Thank you very much. In my opinion, I think to actually foster genuine people-to-people relationship, must be able to understand and build a mutual relationship. And this is the basis of this theme this year, understanding each other, understanding our cultures, telling our stories, and sharing ideas, co-creating ideas, working together, giving sovereignty in the areas of medical and manufacturing. I think it's high time Nigeria moves away from being an aid country to a developing country. And that's what China is doing. China is a partner in the development process of third world countries. And that is why it's pushing forward. We should know each other. We should be able to work together. We should create policies that will guide us and lead and change the narratives of Nigeria and Africa towards a developmental stage. So I think this is very important.
Okay, let me go to Mr. Dong Sai joining us and get this perspective also. Dr. Adetoro here talked about the need for jointly creating the policies. Would you say this is enough to create the results that both countries want when it comes to the issue of people-to-people relations?
I would say they are very important starting points, but they are still not enough on their own. During my time in Nigeria, especially at the University of Ibadan, I met many students who were very curious about China. Some asked about the Chinese language, some asked about the studying in China, and some like simply wanted to know what everyday life in China is real life. But after that, after the first curiosity, the conversation really become much more practical. Some students would just ask me, if I learn Chinese, what I can actually do with it? Can it help me join a project or something? Can I get an internship? If I learn Chinese, can I meet a lot of Chinese students or build a career path? So that is why I think language learning and policy, like a coordination, is necessary, but they are only the foundation. So real people-to-people exchanges start when people move from learning about each other to doing something together.
So, Dr. Oyelami, I want you to give us the perspective from Nigeria here. What barriers do you find still exist in limiting closer cooperation?
Language is a major barrier, too. And there's a lot of narrative within the Nigerian community about Chinese products. You know, we started with Chinese products. You know, before the China relationship with Nigeria, we were used to the Western country, Britain, US. But when Chinese products started coming in, there's this narrative, it's not of good qualities and all of that. All of that, they are, you know, major barrier. Language, you know, we have to change the stereotype, the impressions on the part of the Nigerians that Chinese products are good and all of that. You know, we have to drive it from both the language and the custom and trade relations. Good trade relation means that people will mutually coexist and do very well together.
All right, let's hear first from...
Meanwhile, two pilots have been killed after the plane at collided at New York's LaGuardia Airport.
We begin with breaking news from New York, where a passenger plane has collided with a fire engine on the runway at LaGuardia Airport. These are live pictures from the scene. The pilot and co-pilot of the Air Canada Express plane are both reported to have died, and dozens more people have been injured. The flight from Montreal, which had 72 passengers on board, had just landed and was slowing down when it hit the fire truck as it crossed the runway to respond to another incident. The airport has been closed and all flights halted until further notice. Jeffrey Thomas is an aviation analyst. He told us what his observations were about what we've been seeing and hearing.
Look, it appears as though the flight, which was from Montreal on a CRJ-900, which carries about 76 passengers and crew on top, it landed, and as it was rolling off the runway onto the taxiway, it has collided with a fire truck, which was responding to another incident at LaGuardia Airport. Now, whether that's a breakdown from air traffic control, whether it was the pilot breakdown, or whether it was the fire truck not understanding what was going on, we don't know, obviously. But the two have collided clearly from the vision we're seeing. Tragically, two people have lost their lives, and we understand there's multiple injuries to the passengers, so, and also to the some of the fire truck folks. So it's a serious incident, and it shouldn't have happened. With modern technology, it should not have happened.
Jeffrey, just to confirm what you said about the two fatalities, Reuters news agency are now confirming that sadly to be the case. I mean, coming into land is always a sort of perilous moment, isn't it? A controlled landing is what everybody is after, but it just shows that there are still dangers on the ground. So what precautions are ordinarily taken to make sure that these collisions don't happen on the runway when it can be quite busy?
Well, all the aircraft have transponders, which is giving out their signal, which is what you track on Flight Radar 24. Everybody can track it. Also, the ground vehicles at most airports also have transponders on them, so air traffic control can see where the vehicles are on the runways or the taxiways. So there should be a complete control. Now, whether instructions are misunderstood, whether this system was working or not working, there's a multitude of questions there about why this happened. But certainly the technology is in place at modern airports, and airports, you know, throughout Europe, the United Kingdom, the United States, Australia, all these airports have the very latest in the technology to track aircraft and ground equipment to make sure that they don't collide. So there's been a serious breakdown, tragically.
And, of course, the ramifications are that the airport is now closed until further notice, which can hold up flights all over the world. So it's so interconnected is everything. What will the focus then be of the investigation that necessarily will come from this incident?
Well, the investigation will focus on the instructions given to the flight crew on their landing. Were they told to pull up and exit from an earlier taxiway? And they didn't, and they continued to roll through to the next one. It'll also focus on the instructions given to the fire truck and then also what instructions air traffic control were giving to the various parties involved and whether they were following those things. I mean, one of the things that can happen from time to time is that, you know, these airports are very complex places with lots and lots of taxiways, lots and lots of lights. Was there a misunderstanding about what taxiway to exit at? These are the sorts of things they'll be looking at to try and ascertain where it all went wrong.
Aviation analyst Geoffrey Thomas.
And with that, we have now come to the conclusion after this episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dengue program brought to you by Loisa Shimi. And from 16:30, the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut comes your way. From Indafa, happy Juju. It's goodbye once again.